Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Thanks for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. It's Wednesday, August 6th. Most students across the state return to the classroom this week. We hear from a principal on Maui about an unsettling start on the first day of classes. We check in on a proposed ban of feeding feral animals on the island of Hawaii. We hold a civil debate between two people on either side of the issue. What's this about exploring the universe by car? We hear from a professor who is helping to trick out a vehicle for NASA to take to the moon. We meet the most common bird in our state on this week's Mono Minute, plus the University of Hawaii's production of the hit musical Rent is hitting the road and heading to the Garden Isle. On Friday, the congregation of Maria Lanakila Church will gather to remember 22 of their parishioners who died in the Maui wildfires 2 years ago. The church itself survived the flames and serves as a beacon of hope. The memorial mass will be held Friday evening at 6 p.m. We talked to one of the church members who also serves as the principal of Sacred Heart School, which lost its campus to the fires. Tonata Lolesio talked with us yesterday afternoon and recalled how the scare on the first day of school made for an unsettling start to the new academic year. Since the fires, the school had been operating out of tents, but they started this year off in more suitable facilities, a temporary location in Ka'anapali, until a new school campus can be rebuilt.
After the wildfires, we're holding on to that hope that things out here will continue to progress forward, that families will continue to have renewed hope in their faith and in their community and their government leaders and community leaders and just the people that are continuing to help renew and rebuild West Maui. That hope will strengthen so that plans will get completed, families will have their homes rebuilt and move back into their homes from where they are. There are families that are still displaced and are still having to deal with the issue of housing. And just also, you know, the ongoing social, emotional, mental health issues that families are experiencing because of the rebuilding, because of the maybe some of the situations that they can't resolve with regards to rebuilding or employment or housing. You know, we want to bring home the message of being pilgrims of hope this week and offer that hope through faith in prayer and through our parish and school community.
Well, you know, you suffered a major loss with your parishioners perishing in that fire. And while we are very hopeful that the church stood strong, you did lose the school. And as principal over there, I mean, the students have just returned to the classroom.
Yes. Actually, we're kind of a high alert right now in a sense where, you know, we've just experienced the tsunami warning last week. And then just yesterday, which was actually our first day of school, we had a fire evacuation and a fire warning. The fire was real close to Ka'anapali. We could see the smoke billowing from exactly where we are. And that brought about a lot of post-traumatic experiences. But thanks be to God, we had already planned to dismiss early yesterday, not knowing that this was going to take place. So we were all cleared. Everyone was safely home. But for those of us like myself who stayed back and watched all of that unfold right here in Ka'anapali, where we would never have expected a fire that size to take place right down the highway from us north, it brought about a lot of emotions and worry, not being sure about whether this fire will be contained. But the firefighters and the police officers, the first responders, they sprung into action and they contained that fire and put it out, or put it down, like they said, knocked it down right away. at least they did it while the light was still out. And that was really reassuring and comforting and just gave us a sense of hope that, hey, no matter what disaster comes our way now, things are going to, you know, I guess in a sense I'm trying to say we're more aware, we're more prepared. I like to say that I've kind of hardened my heart in a sense to the situations that happen out here, just in a positive way, knowing it'll all turn out okay in the end, because we've been there, done that. And we kind of know who's going to come together and who has the plans to keep the community safe. But that was kind of a wake-up call for all of us at the school, because we were so close to that fire yesterday. And so this morning when everyone returned to school, the assembly was about putting safety as making safety a priority. So just asking children, listen, you can practice safety right now. You don't have to wait for a big emergency or a big fire in the community to talk about or think about or practice safety. It can happen in small ways at the school that you can be taught about and prepare yourselves for something bigger if it ever happens again. And just also just being hopeful. Whatever we go through, like what we went through yesterday and last week, all that worry, you know, and all the anxiety, and that we look for hope in our families that are there for us to protect us because they know what to do, that we look for hope in our first responders and our firefighters and our police officers and everyone who's monitoring and looking out for us as well and for our safety, and having hope in our faith.
This is a real lesson in resiliency, isn't it?
Absolutely. I think for our students and our faculty and staff, having returned to in-person instruction 3 weeks right after wildfires and teaching out of a makeshift tent school up north for a whole year prior to having been blessed with this new temporary location where at least we have the basic four walls and air condition that we prayed for, it's been a lesson of resilience, of great faith, trust, and hope. And really, we want children and families who are a part of our school community to see that we, you know, that there are people that are really loving and caring on them, and that we're here for them. The school is here for them. Their school community is here for them. And as long as you have a community, a second home, I guess you should say, or a second Ohana to help you get through times like this, you're going to end up being okay. You have to have people in your lives that are really caring for you, praying for you, and being there for you in your time of need, offering that hope.
Well, you are in this temporary location. I know, you know, there are folks that are working on a replacement school back at Maria Lanakila, but it's going to be an adjustment, and you have to have patience.
Yes. Yes, more than patience. I think it's just trusting each other to pull through. You know, everybody has a role to play when it comes to situations like this. Getting back to Lahaina, I like to say that's our promised land. Right now we're on this desert journey. You know, it's a faith journey back home. And when we get there, which we hope will be in about 2 years, we'll get there and we'll celebrate and be happy. But for now, really taking things that one day at a time and making sure we take care of what's important right now. We still look forward with hope to the future, and we're still planning, but we're entrusting all of that, not just to the people who are helping specifically with rebuilding our school back in Lahaina, but entrusting all of our plans to God, knowing He was there for us right after the wildfires. He's there for us right here in Kaanapali, and He'll guide our way back, because this is His school after all. We're just here to help.
All right. Well, yeah. Anything else you can add about, I don't know how you folks are supporting the families of the fire victims there, you know, who we lost?
Yes. When news got out that we were out there providing in-person instructions to any families out here in West Maui and Lahaina who want a place, a safe space for their child to be in, and also, you know, a place where they can learn while they're wherever they go afterwards, after bringing their kids to us, they can go and process, you know, what's happened to their family, or start planning, or start reaching out for resources. But we were kind of that safe space for their kids.
That was Tonata Lalesio, principal of Sacred Heart School, who we talked to yesterday afternoon. The school campus was destroyed in the fire, but the church survived the blaze and serves as a symbol of hope for the parish as it looks to rebuild. Maria Lanikila Church will hold a mass at 6 p.m. Friday to remember the 22 members of their congregation who died in the wildfires.
Support for HPR comes from Leeward Theater. Popolo'heno, Songs of Resilience and Joy, is a musical initiative celebrating the African experience in Hawaii August 16th with Kalani Pea and other artists.
Hawaii Public Radio has been recognized with 8 Excellence in Journalism Awards from the Society of Professional Journalists Hawaii Chapter, including Best Overall News Site. HPR is committed to serving the people of Hawaii, on air and online, wherever you are. View the full list of HPR's winning stories at hawaiipublicradio.org/awards.
Support for HPR comes from Hawaiian Airlines, now with more destinations in partnership with Alaska Airlines, serving the islands for 95 years and committed to serving Hawaii for the next generations to come. HawaiianAirlines.com.
At this hour, a county council meeting is underway on the Big Island. On the agenda is a contentious bill that would prohibit anyone from feeding stray or feral animals on county property, with the exception of certified community cat caretakers. Hours of public testimony for the bill have shown just how polarizing this topic is. Given the passion on both sides of the issue, our producer Maddie Bender wanted to put people in conversation with one another. She invited two people with differing views to have a civil discussion about this bill. Matt Kane'ali'i Kleinfelder is the councilman for the Punamauka area who introduced the bill and supports it. Elaine Parlo is vice president at Action for Animals, a rescue and animal adoption organization. She opposes the measure. We start with an introduction.
And we found this out in the sound check, but do you know each other?
No.
I don't. But it is nice to meet you.
Yep, nice to meet you.
What informs your position? So what experiences have you had in your life that informs your stance?
I started off in rescue as a feeder at the Ke'au transfer station, feeding the abandoned cats that are there. The vast majority are not feral anyway, they're abandoned pets. So I saw the effect of them having food and medical care, because we would always trap new abandoned cats and get them fixed. And also take care of any other medical issues that showed if somebody was sick or injured. And then Shipman changed the contract with the county and said there was no more feeding.
Each year, my ohana and some nonprofits, the county, we all get together and we light up the gardens at Ilio Okalani Gardens in downtown Hilo. And we've been doing it for maybe 5 years now. In the last year, there were 3 nene that were nesting in the gardens. And as we were approaching the actual days of our event and getting ready, prepping everyone, we learned that there was a gosling that was hatched from the 3 nene that were nesting there. And it was exciting, but it was also worrisome because we have to block off that area and make sure the public is not there in the evening hours. Plus, we're bringing lights in. So, as you know, there's some work involved in making sure that we're protecting the native species in the gardens as we have this event. 2 days prior to actually bringing the lights down, we learned that the nene gosling was missing, and then it was found dead. I remember watching a little chihuahua chase the 3 nene, adult nene, that were nesting. And then when I'm hearing that our endangered species are actually being killed, and then to find out later that they actually died of toxoplasmosis, really was a concern to me. If our goal as a species is to protect our native species, specifically endangered species in Hawaii and we're not doing our utmost to do so, then we have to do more.
Could I address that gosling that died? It was, of course, examined. It was not actually definitely proven that it was the toxoplasmosis that killed it. They kept saying that it indicated it could possibly be, but the gosling was also very emaciated, and it also had blood on it. It was injured in some way they didn't specify.
Matt, what do you think the outcome of this bill passing would be?
It's a very different bill from the one I walked in. It's been amended by multiple council members, and mostly due to trying to find a way forward for the community that came to testify and with assistance from Parks and Recreation and the administration. Should the bill go forward, the organizations that are county authorized will be able to function within the county parks. But the intent here is to make sure that we don't have the proliferation of any feral animals in the park. And I really need to kind of hammer on that point. The bill doesn't say cats. The bill says feral animals. So we're really trying to address here all of the different circumstances that we have in our parks. Because if you go anywhere in Puna, we have wild hogs. If you're in Waikoloa, you have goats. If you're on Mauna Kea, you have sheep. We're only talking about county facilities. And so there's some really important points, I think, that have been overlooked in the scramble to make sure we're not taking away from one program. But reality is, we're talking about all animals in county facilities and prohibiting the feeding of. And where we stand today, the program and a lot of the testifiers who are seeking resolution to be able to do what they want to do, to work on trap and neuter release programs, or to continue feeding in an effort to reduce the number of, in this case, cats, those programs will be able to continue. So it's interesting to see the evolution of the bill and to hear the public outcry, when I really do feel that the council and the government is listening to the people, and it's not a blatant disregard as we see maybe in other places in America. And it is a very polarizing issue, but I do feel like we've really strove to find a healthy balance between what's being asked, what the problems we're facing are, and how to begin to address that in the community. Is it the perfect solution? No, it's not. But is it a piece of the solution? Is it a step in the right direction? Yes, it is.
Elaine, I have the same question for you, which is, what do you think the outcome of this bill passing would be?
I think it will be that cats will be very hungry, starving, and they will be looking for food. They've been fed for years. So they will be going into the hotels, the apartment buildings, businesses, other homes, the picnic tables where people are trying to have their lunch and their picnics and their snacks, frantic for food. So they're going to be really creating a lot of chaos in the area. They'll be, you know, going further out looking for food too and getting run over on the roads. Tourists and local families will start seeing dying and dead kittens, because the kittens are going to die first when they don't have food. So it's not a very good look.
I have a follow-up for each of you, and Elaine, you can start with this. But essentially my question is, what will you do if you're wrong and the outcome that the other side has is what comes to pass?
I'm not exactly sure what the outcome. I mean, I guess they're hoping that the cats will just go away. When they stop getting fed, they're going to go away. If they do, okay, that's great. They're going to go somewhere else, though. So they're going to be somewhere in the vicinity and just move the problem to another place. That's as far as I can see. But if they disappear from county facilities, then that's great.
And council member, same question of, what would you do if Elaine's vision for the outcome of this bill comes true?
I've learned in my 6 years that no one is ever 100% right. Legislation is never perfect. We do our best and we move on. If Elaine's group is right, the bill fails, we move on and we keep going. If it ends up that I'm right, or that there's things that need to be changed, then we can work on that legislatively. Bills can be amended, code can be amended. So to me, I see it as a very open collaboration, not just a one-sided, I'm right, you're wrong, and we're moving on. Even the way that the bill has progressed to today, I mean, that really is the beauty of the legislative process and working well, and democracy in America.
If I can be completely honest, I feel a bit like you are talking at or past each other and not directly to each other. I mean, I've seen both of you do it in the way you will use like they when there is a very obvious you, you know, right in front of you that holds the opposite stance. I'd love if we could kind of refocus here and just ask, starting with you, Elaine, what is one question you have for Matt?
Matt, what do you think is the immediate result if all the feeders are stopped from feeding, which I think is supposed to happen in January? That was one of the amendments. If the feeders all just say, okay, I don't want to get in trouble, we'll stop feeding. What do you think is you're going to see on the ground?
Well, my common sense brain, yeah, and I am a man, so that's not always correct, as my wife tends to tell me quite frequently. My common sense brain says, if we were to stop feeding and it just ended, and we're only talking about public facilities now, so we're going to limit it to that, meaning if we're not, if it's in a park, if it's in a transfer station, feeding stops, I believe we will see a decline in the population. What I've come to see in my lifetime is when you provide constant food, constant water, and the things that are a necessity in life, and you provide those constantly, then you will see an influx of whatever it is that wants those things, whether it be homeless people for services, whether it be cats for a feeding colony, whether it be birds to bird food, wherever you set up and create the necessities for life and you constant that, then you create more of a problem. And when we do that in our public facilities, where we have people, where we have children, where we have some endangered species, then we're really, to me, we're doing a disservice to both our environment and or our people. So that's what my common sense brain, if I got to dig into data and prove one way or another, science or this or that, I mean, we can get into that. But if we eliminated the feeding, I don't think that animals would just die of starvation and fall over and be found dead everywhere. They're going to move to a different area. That's how I see it, Elaine.
So I'm wondering also, how enforceable do you think this is? And how do you think it's going to look to arrest a bunch of grannies that are feeding cats?
Well, first off, if the bill passes, you know, that's the first thing to be seen. If it passes, and in January 1, 2026, let's say signs are up, because that gives us, you know, 4 months to put signs up, notify the public. Our police department is very forgiving. It's going to be animal control or police department or a combination of both, possibly giving out tickets to people if they're feeding cats and they're not part of a cat caretaking feeding program or a certified cat feeder, whatever we're calling it. Should they be an instance of someone not having a cat caretaker card and our police department, you know, really kind of cracks down on somebody, and if it is a granny, as you would say, I think our police department and our animal control officers are pretty good folks who show a lot of aloha. So I don't see this being a crackdown. This isn't going to be ICE breaking down doors to arrest grannies trying to feed cats. This is going to be more of a gentle rollout, an educational rollout, like most programs that are new are, as we walk into letting people know that this isn't allowed anymore and then going from there.
My last question, and starting with you, Matt, what's one thing that you heard Elaine say that you either agree with, or if you can't agree with it, you can at least appreciate the logic there, or you can appreciate her sentiment?
I do appreciate the idea that, because I'm an animal lover, I have cats, I have dogs, I have chickens, we have a small farm, and I love all my animals, so I'm not an animal hater, you know, first off, but I hear the concern, and it's very human to want to take care of things that need help. I mean, that's a basic human thing. We all have that in different capacities. So I completely understand that what I believe is perceived as when this happens, all the animals will starve and have hardship. So I'll just stop right there. I hear you. And I think what we've done to date with the amendments to the bill begins to carve out a piece of how that won't happen in our community and how that we do hear you. And that's one thing I'd like to kind of meet you in the middle with. And thank you for the conversation today.
And Elaine, what's one thing that you've heard Matt say that you agree with or appreciate the sentiment?
The concern for the endangered species, because I am too. I'm very concerned. We do, at least we know that the nene are rebounding, so that's encouraging. But I know it is an issue, and I really hope that that you and the council and DLNR and Parks and Recreation can do a little more to protect them, to feed them, to make sure that they are always rebounding. And I'm becoming more and more around the islands, we can see them. I just talked to somebody who's lived here for years who's never seen a nene, never in her life has seen a nene on this island. I just like, what? But yeah, we want them. We want them. We love them.
That was Elaine Parlow from Action for Animals and Hawaii County Council member Matt Kenealii Kleinfelder. They spoke with HPR's Maddie Bender. And one point of clarification, we did receive the autopsy report from the 2024 death of the Nene Gosling in Liliuokalani Gardens in Hilo. Laboratory findings pointed to toxoplasmosis as the Gosling's cause of death.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors PCAT, Pacific Center for Advanced Technology Training, and the Rice Partnership.
The Apple TV Plus series Chief of War is out, and if you've got questions, listen to HPR's podcast, Feathers and Fire. I'm Russell Subiono. Join me and Mehana Makainai as we discuss the themes of each episode and talk about our favorite parts. New episodes of Feathers and Fire are available Saturdays on all podcast platforms and at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for HPR comes from the Honolulu Board of Water Supply with a mission to provide fresh water to the people of Oahu, committed to conserving and protecting Oahu's water resources since 1929. BoardofWaterSupply.com.
Shoot for the stars, and just maybe you'll end up on the moon. University of Hawaii scientists were recently awarded a contract to build a scientific instrument that will travel to the moon. The NASA Lunar Terrain Vehicle will launch later this decade, and it will be outfitted with a detector to look for ice. Matt Ziegler is the leading the team for UH. He gave the conversation's Maddie Bender a crash course on the history of space cars.
You know, there are two ways we explore the universe with cars. Right? One of them is with an autonomous rover that is usually a 4 or 6 wheel little battery powered car that drives itself around, like the Mars rovers on Mars. Now that we're familiar with, when humans came to the moon, you know, back in the late 60s, early 70s, they could only get so far. Like, so Apollo 11, 12, they were just walking as far as they could go. They could haul back as many rocks as they could hold in their hand. Apollo 14, they got fancy and they carried a rickshaw. And then on Apollo 15, some engineers from GM came to NASA and said, we think we could supply you a rover that the astronauts could drive around. And we want the first car on the moon to be a GM car. And they said, no, we don't really have room for that. Well, actually, we've got this one like bay that's like 2 feet by 4 feet. If you could fit in there and we'd only have to push one button or pull one lever to set up the car, we'd go for that. And these engineers actually did it and took it totally upon themselves. And it was back then, it was a commercial vehicle that was being added to this NASA mission. And so now we find ourselves in the same situation again 50 years later, where we have NASA sending humans to the moon. They want to send a rover that the astronauts can drive around and do it in as cheap a way as possible. And so they're contracting commercial companies to build this car that the astronauts will drive around.
So that's where we are right now of this LTV, this Lunar Terrain Vehicle. And one of the, I guess, cool facets of this is that you get to put all types of scientific instruments on the LTV. So give us a sense of you know, where UH and your work fit into this.
Okay, so this rover is going to go to the moon between the Artemis 4 and 5 missions, which should happen sometime before the end of the decade. And this rover, we had a competition this last year to add scientific instruments. They only selected two, and we got lucky that one of ours, headed out of University of Hawaii, was one of the two selected instruments. The other one is like a infrared camera to look around and see into cold places. And then ours is an instrument to see deep underground using radio waves. Kind of the exciting science that Artemis is doing, different from the Apollo missions, is that it's going to the south pole of the moon, to a place where we think there's ice buried deep underground, or maybe at the surface as well. And so this infrared camera has some channels that can see, oh, is there water ice or is there carbon dioxide ice on the surface? And then our instrument peers deep underground down to probably about 15, 20 feet at least, hopefully deeper, to be able to measure temperatures underground and to measure the reflection of radio waves from deep underground. And with that, we think we should be able to characterize if there's ice, how much there is, and how deep it is. The big picture of why we want to find ice on the moon kind of dates back to the idea of we don't know why there's water on Earth. The solar system and all of our models of how solar systems form should be bone dry, basically out as far as Jupiter. And yet somehow we have ice that is at the poles of the moon and the poles of Mercury on the planet Mars and all the water we have here on Earth. Where did this come from? And on Earth, we have plate tectonics that's kind of recycled everything into the interior of the Earth and back out again. And we don't really have a record here of where the water came from. The moon has basically been sitting there like a piece of flypaper for the last 4.5 billion years. And any ice that has gotten to the moon, a comet that hit the moon or whatever source you want to call, that has basically stuck in these polar shadowed craters. So we call them permanently shadowed craters or PSRs. They're literally places where the sun don't shine. And so these permanently shadowed craters on the moon are a really exciting place to explore the history of water in the solar system and how it got transported around.
So talk a little bit about the device that you're designing, how that process works, and also the considerations for it, you know, being exposed to space, which is not really a friendly climate.
What's kind of fun is that any spacecraft instrument is the same in some sense. And so University of Hawaii has launched several CubeSats, or small satellites that are maybe the size of a cereal box or maybe the value size big cereal box. And so now we're building an instrument kind of that same size. And the moon, in some ways, is an easier environment than open space, and in some ways is a tougher environment. We have to worry about less temperature ranges than you would floating around in orbit of the Earth, but we also have to worry about contamination from dust and hopefully the rover not bottoming out and not smashing on the ground, because we're going to be our instrument will be mounted on the belly of the rover, looking down into the interior. And what we are doing is looking in radio waves. So we both look in passive radio waves. And if you think about it, so infrared tells us about the temperature at the surface. And then microwave, which is a longer wavelength than infrared, will tell you about temperatures a little below the surface. And then radio is a little longer wavelength, will tell you temperatures deeper down. And so we look at those radio emissions as a function of depth or a function of frequency, and we can actually piece together what the temperatures are underground. And then along with that, we have a ground-penetrating radar instrument that's coming from the German Space Agency, from DLR, and they are going to have an active source that sends a radio wave into the ground, and that might bounce off of things like rocks under the surface or buried ice.
So you have a delivery date of this device in the next few years. What is the process going to look like? What are you working on?
Yeah, so what have we gotten ourselves into? So over the next 2.5 years, myself and a couple of the other the project managers at University of Hawaii, we kind of get to direct these other agencies that are helping build parts of the instrument. So we have some components coming from the German Space Agency. We have an antenna being built at Ohio State University. And we have this microwave radiometer part that is built at Jet Propulsion Lab. JPL is going to glue all those things together. And then they kind of send the final packaged instrument to University of Hawaii, where at the Hawaii Space Flight Lab, we're going to do the final testing and making sure everything's all buttoned up and ready to go to the moon.
Will there be opportunities for students to get involved with some of this research?
I mean, that's the whole point of being at a university and working. And it's really exciting to bring this instrument to University of Hawaii that has had some spacecraft and instruments built here, but never anything going to the surface of the moon. And when it's like dealing with astronauts and they're sticking it on rover to the moon, it just feels more exciting. And so that's the kind of excitement that really gets students excited, and we can get them involved. Once the instrument's on the moon, our plan is to have a student-run operation center. It will help monitor the data coming down from the moon and active on that. And then we're hoping to get students involved working with the engineers as the project's being built.
That's awesome. I'm picturing like Mission Control, but it's all 18-year-olds.
Yeah, all 18-year-olds and Tevas and.
Yeah. Oh, that'll be really fun. And then I just have to ask about budget cuts and funding uncertainty. And there are almost two prongs of this, right? Because NASA's budget itself is being proposed to be slashed. On the other hand, you have individual scientists and university professors like yourself experiencing cuts from National Science Foundation, or if they work on the more medical side, NIH, National Institutes of Health. How does it feel to be thinking 2.5 years in advance for an agency that is kind of going through it right now?
Yeah, and this was kind of the irony of the day we won our $20 million proposal. There was also the release of NASA's research program for the year came out the same day, being slashed by 3/4 or so. And so it's nice personally to be one of the lucky ones right now where, okay, I feel like we have a secure future, and the Artemis program out of all the programs is one of the most secure, seeming at least, from NASA, that I think we are legitimately pushing forward with humans to the moon. That's kind of popular on both sides of the aisle. And so it will happen. We're going to send these people to the moon. They're going to take this rover. They're going to need this instrument. And so it's a nice, certain thing to hold. But it is a challenge of how do we help the community and help as many students as possible. And we are really worried about this. Will there be a brain drain where we have this couple-year period where, oh, maybe it's not as many people want to work for NASA in the future as they did, or there aren't as many opportunities to take on new students and such. And so it's exciting that we have, through projects like this that have gotten lucky, to have the ability to help University of Hawaii students to keep going and keep NASA going in that respect.
That was UH Planetary Geophysics Researcher Matt Ziegler talking with HPR's Maddie Bender. We'll have concept illustrations of the lunar vehicle on our website later today. This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio, and we now go to this week's Manu Minute. University of Hawaii at Hilo professor Patrick Hart introduces us to a familiar friend, the Majiro.
The warbling wide-eye, or Majiro, is a non-native bird that was first introduced to Hawaii from Japan in 1929. It is now the most common bird in all of Hawaii, occurring just about everywhere. They're green and gray with a very distinctive white ring around their eyes, and they're only about 4 inches tall. So small, they're more often heard than seen. White eyes are known as generalists. They eat a variety of food, such as insects, fruit, and nectar. They're considered competitors when they live in the same forests as our native birds. For Hawaii Public Radio, I'm Patrick Hart from the Department of Biology at the University of Hawaii at Hilo.
Support for Manu Minute comes from the Hawaii Audubon Society, connecting the community with the Manu Oku through programs to promote awareness, appreciation, and conservation of the official bird of Honolulu. Learn more at hiaudubon.org.
Production of the hit show Rent is coming to Kauai after a successful run at Oahu's Kennedy Theater. The production is directed by Joshua Baba Tavares, an assistant professor at Manoa. And Tavares has a long history with the show. In 2020, he played Angel in the national touring company of Rent. And Tavares recently spoke with the Conversation's D.W. Gibson about the upcoming performances at the Kauai Community College's Performing Arts Center.
So for those who don't know Rent, give us a quick thumbnail. What's the story?
Rent follows a group of young artists living on the Lower East Side of Manhattan during the 80s and 90s, so the height of the AIDS epidemic. And they're just navigating life and loss and friendship, relationships, and trying to figure out who they are. And yeah, so that's the story of Rent.
Sounds like life.
That is life.
Well, and it has loose ties to a work of opera, too, no?
Definitely, yes. La Boheme, Puccini's La Boheme. So it's loosely inspired by that and written by Jonathan Larson, made its Broadway debut in 1996.
Yeah, and still resonating all these years later. Well, and this particular production is presented through a uniquely Hawaiian lens. What does that look like?
So, yes, we did the show back in February and March at the Kennedy Theater at University of Hawaii at Manoa. And we had just little nods to Hawaii because we feel like there's so many themes in the show that resonate today, like houselessness, homelessness, gentrification, substance abuse, and then just relationships and beautiful things like love and perseverance and all that stuff. So we're still honoring the show and placing it in New York City during the 80s and 90s. But there's little nods to Hawaii, like our payphones are the Hawaii payphones. And on our costumes, we've woven in some Hawaiian fabrics and Hawaiian designers in there just to give little nods and little Easter eggs to kind of discover throughout watching the show. And yeah, we open with an oli, a chant and stuff like that. So things that just still make it feel like, even though it is a period piece, it also can reflect downtown Honolulu and experiences that we have here on the island as well.
As someone who saw the original production on Broadway, It struck me in such a funny way to hear it as a period piece, but it is. We're all these years later. And there's this distance, right, that we have now. Mm-hmm. Sometimes mm-hmm. that distance can give some extra clarity.
Yeah.
What do you think it is that really resonates all these years later with this particular show?
I think it's how do you move forward? How do you, you know, it's corny and cheesy now because it's the title of the popular song from the show, but how do you measure your life, right? And then it suggests different ways. And it can be something profound and deep, like love and forgiveness and respect, to those kinds of qualities. But it also can be like the simple mundane things like day-to-day finding parking or, you know, a cup of coffee. And so Jonathan Larson captures that essence so beautifully in that song, Seasons of Love. And I think that really is the core message of the show, reminding you in the craziness of the world, because the world is always kind of crazy, how do you stop and pause and reflect on what's important, and how are you going to measure your life, right? Because you have a choice to a certain degree on how you're going to do that.
Yeah, how you're going to measure your life, how you're going to measure ultimately success and happiness.
Yeah, because I think that that's also different for everybody, and it's okay too for it to be different. And I think that that's the beauty of the characters in the show. They're all so different. But it really is an ensemble show. There's no one lead. Every individual is important, but really it's the collective. How do we come together? And so there's another kind of idea there with Hawaiian thinking. You know, as a Hawaiian actor and director myself, that's kind of what I like to bring into all of my works, even if it's not necessarily a show that was written for Hawaii or, you know, didn't have that in mind. But the idea of kākou, right? How do we come together and collectively work together as a community? And Rent is a community show.
Yeah, community and made family, right? Friends that come together and become family. As you said earlier, I think this show can, on the one hand, be teleportation, let's say, back to New York City in the early 1990s. But I also think at the same time, audience members might be surprised at some of the issues that the characters are facing, and you nodded to these earlier, mm-hmm. and how familiar they might seem. New York and Hawaii couldn't be more different in so many ways, yeah. but my goodness, do we have matching housing issues,
yes,
right?
Yes, so many different issues. Yeah, from the housing crisis, you know, and just how difficult it is. These artists in this story, in Rent, are squatters. They can't afford to pay their rent because of the gentrification of the area they're living in, which is huge in Hawaii too, gentrification and, you know, being priced out of paradise in different ways, which is a very real thing. So we don't try to shy away from that at all in the show. And yeah, if you blink, maybe you think it's downtown Honolulu, it's Kaka'ako, it's Chinatown, it's all these places that are gentrified, even though the story takes place in New York City. And then, yeah, substance abuse and mental health issues, all of those things are very prevalent today as well. For me, theater, art, storytelling always boils down to healing, planting a seed of healing. So how do we plant that seed of conversation, maybe to find ways to heal through these things? And then also celebrate and have fun. It doesn't all have to be so heavy and traumatic and drama, even though we love drama, right? Save the drama for the stage, I always say. But also the celebration of it all and the camaraderie and the people coming together and uplifting each other. So there's beautiful things and positive, encouraging things in the show as well.
I think that's one of the things that has made the show so successful over the years, certainly when it first came out, is that sense of celebration. I know it was energizing for people that were waiting outside on hot New York City streets to get, you know, discounted tickets the day of, and had seen it already 10 times. Mm-hmm. It was a sense of, it can be a show that is vivifying.
Definitely. I think that's why it's still relevant and holds weight till today, 30 years later. So for it to still resonate with audiences today, I think speaks to the core of the show, which is, yeah, love and celebration and, you know, even through the hard times, finding ways to be resilient and to push through together.
Well, some of the issues that you mentioned that the show tackles in terms of substance abuse and housing and gentrification, those are all issues that politicians wrestle with and try to come up with policies to address.
Right.
That's not what art does, right? Art doesn't create policy. So what does art do? What does art give us beyond the sense of community? What does art give us when faced with such difficult, intractable issues?
I think for me, it's like this 2.5 hours or so where you're in a theater together and you make this unspoken agreement to kind of buy into this world and to figure out who these characters are, what they're going through. Are they going to come out on top? Are they going to fail? Are they? And we get to reflect and hold a mirror up to ourselves too, right? Who do we resonate with? Who do we hate? Who do we love? Who are we rooting for and why? And then I think it just, even if you're not like going home and theorizing so much about every little moment, right? I think it is something that can move you and carve out a little place in your heart and in your mind of how you're going to navigate through the world. So I think that little unspoken pact that you make as an audience member, we come together for this sacred amount of time to share this story, and then we release it, and that's it. It's not something that you can replay like a movie or a TV show. It's just for that little glimpse of time. And then again, yeah, that idea of planting a seed of healing, to me, that's what every show boils down to. It changes your mind maybe a little bit. It challenges you to open up a little bit more. Maybe you walked in thinking beforehand, nope, I don't agree with this, or I already have my mindset on this one particular issue. And maybe through a song or through some sort of interpretation that a character offers or a look, right? It doesn't even necessarily have to be dialogue. It can potentially change you or give you something, another perspective, challenge you maybe a little bit to open up.
Open up. I think that hits it on the head, because you talked about people going in and seeing the show and maybe identifying a character they relate to. But the great point you made too was that perhaps there'll be characters on stage that you don't relate to that show you something that you couldn't see before, mm-hmm. that expand how you view something, like a topic like squatting, right?
Yeah.
People might bring, I'm sure, some judgments and prejudgments to such an idea of squatting.
Certainly.
And being able to see something like that in a new light.
Mm-hmm. Totally. Yep, that's what theater is, and good storytelling.
How does your experience as a performer inform this experience you've had as a director?
Yeah, that's a great question. I went in knowing that I didn't want to copy-paste what I already knew and what was done, but I was curious and more excited about finding our version and not necessarily trying to redo what was already done. And so that was the only thing that I really knew going into it. I knew that I understood the show and I understood the characters. There was a lot that just came naturally to me and I understood it. And I think that that helped me in a big way. But then I just worked with the actors and I said, bring me your Mimi, bring me your Roger, your Angel. Those are the people that I want to meet. And, you know, from your life experiences and your interpretation, I want to build it off of that.
Well, speaking of people learning the craft of acting, the production is also hosting a workshop on August 9th. Tell us about that.
Yes. So we'll be on Kauai August 8th, 9th, and 10th for performances. So only three performances. And on the 9th, we're going to offer a acting workshop, a free acting workshop for the community there. One of our big goals with going to Kauai is to connect, obviously, with the Kauai community and Kauai actors. And so we want to offer a workshop, and we're going to just teach a combination from the show, so a dance combo. We'll have a talk back with the cast and crew, so you can learn a little bit more about the different experiences from the different actors and, you know, the crew that worked on the show. And it's a huge, like, opportunity for us to recruit, to be honest, anybody on Kauai who's interested in maybe studying acting at the University of Hawaii Manoa. So we'll have a little section focused on TV and film acting as well. And yeah, it's going to be a couple hours. It's going to be fun. It's free and it's open to the public. We're asking for people who are high school age or older. And it's just, again, plant a seed of hopefully a long relationship with the Kauai Community College Performing Arts Center. Hopefully we can take something there every year and continue to reach out to the entire Paiaina, the archipelago of Hawaii, not just Oahu, right, but to take it to Kauai. So this is the first step, and we're hoping to be able to hop to other islands, if not with Rent, with other future shows.
That idea of recruitment, I think, is so important. My colleague did a report on casting for The Chief of War, the mm-hmm. new Apple series, and so much of the reporting that she did there focused on the fact that we need this kind of recruitment to cultivate young actors so that casting directors and productions can know that there's a wealth of performers here to call upon.
Exactly. So it's huge. It's actually really the levels of significance this trip, you know, it's fun. It's going to be fun. But it's also, as we analyze and kind of look at all the things that are happening, it's a huge opportunity for us to connect with the Kauai community. And one of the leads who's on that show, Chief of War, is from Kauai. So there's so many talented people throughout our island chain. And sometimes they just don't have the exposure or the opportunity. So it's very important to cultivate the talent that we have here, right? Because our stories can be told on a global level, and our talent is global. There's this narrative that Hawaiians aren't ready to kind of act, or locals aren't ready. We don't have the caliber of talent, but it's not true. If you don't want to go away, you don't need to. You can stay home and train here, and we can create opportunities here and write our own stories and find ways to get them produced on a global scale, because I do genuinely believe we have so much talent here. We just need to continue to nurture it.
That was Joshua Baba Tavares and HPR's UW Gibson. They were talking about the production of Rent that Tavares directed for the Manoa Theater Department. There will be three performances this weekend on Kauai. For details about showtimes and tickets, head to our website, hawaiipublicradio.org.
625,600 minutes.
Well, we've got to go now, but up tomorrow, we plan to check in on Maui's Jodo Mission. Their temple burned in the fires. We catch up on their plans for the future. What are your thoughts this week as we gone through this anniversary as a community of the Maui wildfires? Leave your feedback on our talkback line, 808-792-8217, or email talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org. You can find our shows online by searching for the Conversation on Spotify or Apple. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.